Okay, folks, welcome back to another We Do Science Guru Performance podcast. It is episode 31, and today I have with me Professor Martin Gibala. Hi, Martin.
Hi.
Did I pronounce your name right?
Yeah, hard G, Gibala, that's Gibala. Correct.
Excellent, good, because I'm always frightened of masquering people's names, only because people usually mask mine, especially my first name. It's kind of crazy. So I'm very grateful to have you on this podcast. As we were just discussing offline, you are, of course, on the other side of the Atlantic, up in Canada. You're in, is it in Hamilton, Ontario?
It is in Hamilton, Ontario. It's about 45 minutes outside of Toronto.
Brilliant. And you are a professor in the Department of Kinesiology at McMaster University.
That's correct.
Yeah. So we, of course, I know Stu Phillips quite well. He's been on this podcast.
He is literally in the office right beside me right
now.
Oh,
my God. Hey, Stu, how you doing? I just told him that I had a baby. In fact, I've got a six-day-old baby. So I'm doing this podcast as an escapism from dirty nappies and the chemical warfare and sleep deprivation and so on. But anyway, that's great to know. So listen, let's get into this. The reason why I wanted to have a chat with you on this podcast is, unless listeners have been living under a rock, which I know most of them haven't, if not all of them, of course, there's this whole sort of popular understanding of high-intensity interval training. And you are largely responsible, I believe, for quote-unquote the craze or the popularity of high-intensity interval training. And I know you've done a lot of research in this area. And the paper that I have read recently in particular, which I think most of the listeners can easily access, is available from the Journal of Physiology back in 2012, which is titled Physiological Adaptations to Low Volume High Intensity Interval Training in Health and Disease. So that is required reading, folks, for this podcast. And then just look up all the references and read all the papers. They're all excellent. So anyway, Martin, can you just give us a quick overview about what high intensity interval training is, firstly?
Yeah, sure. And perhaps to start there, you know, our lab is getting a lot of credit, but I think maybe we've, helped to raise awareness about the potency of this type of training. I think if you look back through the literature, you can almost go back 100 years, you know, back to the Swedish introduction of the term fartlek training, which literally means speed play. So I certainly don't want to overstate our contributions over the last decade or so. And as you would well know, there's a number of excellent researchers in the UK who are also producing some very good studies on HIIT. Mm. You know, our definition is quite simple, and that's simply alternating periods of relatively intense exercise interspersed by periods of complete rest or lower intensity exercise for recovery. So just quite simply, this notion of peaks and valleys.
Excellent. And of course, this has really become a popular topic. And one of the purposes of this podcast is usually to get into performance nutrition or sports nutrition or related sort of physiological or metabolic stuff that contributes to that field. And I think whoever we are, if we're involved in health, fitness, whether it's sports scientists, sports nutritionists or whatever, health, body composition, etc., are all going to be goals that one way or the other we're trying to we're trying to get our clients to achieve, whether they're athletes or regular people. And of course the listeners are going to be a mix of those people. They're either working with elite athletes, recreational athletes, just health and fitness people, or from maybe a more clinical perspective, just trying to utilize exercise for its therapeutic benefits. And high intensity interval training has a value to all of those, doesn't it?
It does. You know, like many of the things we study in exercise science, I think it has its roots in athletics, and you know, there would be few elite endurance athletes who are not utilizing some sort of interval training in their everyday training. But I think what is new, or one of the things we've learned about high intensity interval training over the last decade, is, you know, first of all, the potency of HIIT on its own. So not necessarily supplemented into the already high training volumes that elite athletes tend to undertake. HIIT just on its own is a very potent and effective stimulus. And also the potential applicability of interval training to many different populations, including those with chronic diseases.
Yeah, and I think in your 2012 paper that I referenced, you make a statement there, and I'd be damned if I can find the exact phrase. I literally just had it in front of me. But the biggest excuse almost anybody's going to come across is lack of time, isn't it? And you still find people arguing whether or not high-intensity interval training is better than regular endurance training. And of course, there's swings and roundabouts on this topic. But one thing that is undeniable, of course, is the general public and elite athletes all have huge demands on their time. And this is a particularly wonderful focus for this particular type of training, isn't it?
It's certainly one that gets a lot of attention, and you know, all of the media headlines around our research and the interval training research and from others certainly plays on that theme, the notion of getting fit in a few minutes a week. You know, if you talk to your behavioral colleagues, and you know, clearly some people, I'm sure many of your listeners are indeed very time pressed. For others, of course, it's an excuse. If you know, we just need to look at the amount of time that people spend updating Facebook and things like that. But regardless, in survey after survey, the number one cited barrier for why people do not adhere to the public health guidelines is lack of time. And certainly we've been interested in our research potentially addressing that issue, and just in the fundamental idea of, you know, how little exercise can you get away with, or when we start to play around with intensity and volume, this idea of the intensity duration trade-off. And clearly what our research and the work of others has shown is that if you're willing to work very, very hard, you can get away with a surprisingly small dose of exercise and still reap tremendous benefit.
Sure. So that's a great segue into the next thing I wanted to get into then, which is for folks that are wondering, you know, why is it that something that's short and intense can potentially equal the benefits one way or the other to something that's sort of long and slow, such as endurance training? So could you just sort of give us a bit of background as to sort of the physiology behind this high intensity interval training as it relates to the types of benefits you might also expect from endurance training?
Sure. You know, I know your research, or sorry, your listeners come from a broad spectrum of backgrounds, but overall are quite an educated audience. But I'm surprised, even when I talk to our third and fourth year students, this idea that repeated sprints can be a very potent aerobic stimulus is often lost on people, or not generally well appreciated. You know, clearly if we do a single high intensity sprint, the majority of energy is derived from non-oxidative or anaerobic pathways, although even in something like a 30-second maximal sprint, up to a quarter of the energy is derived from aerobic or oxidative metabolism. If we do repeated sprints, I think the data is very clear that most of the energy is derived from aerobic metabolism. And again, I would point to a number of laboratories in the UK, including previous work by people like Professor Clyde Williams, that done a lot of seminal work on this in the early and mid-90s, that very clearly showed repeated sprinting, most of the energy is derived from aerobic metabolism. And so perhaps it's not surprising then that we have very significant and profound adaptations in the aerobic energy supply systems when we train in this manner. So, you know, that's more, I guess, from a theoretical perspective. Part of what we've done in our research is start to look at some of these molecular signaling pathways that are associated with skeletal muscle remodeling towards a more oxidative phenotype. And indeed, we find that many of these same signaling cascades and signaling proteins that are activated by prolonged endurance-type training can also be stimulated by very short, intense bursts of activity. So literally at the molecular level, we have evidence that the two forms of training can elicit some similar benefits.
Yeah, I mean, we've had all kinds of guests on this podcast, including people like Graham Close and James Morton, who of course have done studies with you on some of these topics or similar topics. For example, where my mind is going with this is the initial observational interpretation of high intensity interval training by some people is, well, hang on, if I'm doing something that's short and fast and intense and I'm just blowing through carbohydrates, how is that going to improve my ability to utilize fats as a fuel and or even burn fat as a fuel? Could you possibly just elucidate a bit more on why that happens?
Yeah, I guess 2 points on that. The first is that we know, and you're right, in order to do very intense sprints, virtually all of the energy is coming from carbohydrate metabolism. And if we measure something like muscle glycogen, we can see that you burn through 25-30% of it, even with a few very short sprints. But in recovery, so point number one, I guess, would be in recovery, you have a dramatic shift in fuel utilization. And so lipid oxidation, even though the overall rate of energy utilization is obviously much lower in recovery, there is a shift towards primarily lipid oxidation. So I guess that's point number one. But point number two would be, you know, when we measure various aerobic oxidative enzymes inside skeletal muscle biopsies, we see that enzymes associated with fat oxidation, so classic enzymes like beta-HAD, which is a very common marker enzyme for the capacity for fat oxidation, is enhanced by interval type training. Obviously, the way that mitochondria remodel in response to exercise is very complex, but you know, some of these marker enzymes that we associate with fat oxidation are enhanced by interval training. And when we've done challenge rides before and after a period of sprint training, we see that the capacity for whole body fat oxidation is also enhanced. So I think the evidence is pretty good that even though it's primarily a carbohydrate-based stimulus, at least in terms of fuel use during the bout, that you can elevate your capacity for fat oxidation as a result of sprint training.
Sure. And of course, it's also worth bearing in mind also, isn't it, that the interval training itself is of course a tool in the toolbox, so to speak, which can be integrated with a number of other strategies. For example, whether you train in the fed state or fasted state, and then of course there's different foods or fuels you may or may not limit or actually consume before the interval training, which again would influence some of those adaptations, I would imagine.
You know, absolutely. I did an interview for the general person who may have just heard of interval training and might want to sort of start to dip their toe in the water. You know, what might they do? And, you know, we talk about very simplistic things like getting out of your comfort zone and that sort of thing. But obviously, you can ramp it up at the other end as well and get, you know, very scientific in your approach and utilize many different strategies, including nutritional manipulation to try and augment the training stimulus. And obviously, if you're going to talk about some sort of training strategy for a very highly trained athlete, the level of detail that would go into the various training considerations is quite different than if you're talking to someone at the other end of the spectrum who is just, you know, maybe a person who's trying to reduce their risk for chronic disease by starting to incorporate this strategy in any way possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a running theme, which seems to be my catchphrase for this whole series of podcasts, is context. And of course, context is, you know, is a big factor with this. And I always encourage my own students and my own staff at Guru Performance to, you know, think about what is it we're trying to achieve with this strategy. You know, we've got the various tools in the toolbox. Whether it's low carb or high carb training, interval training, you know, whatever, you still got to ask yourself, what is it we're actually trying to achieve with this strategy? And unfortunately, what tends to happen in our industry, particularly in the lay area of this, is sort of black and white. And you hear this argument of, well, you know, high intensity interval training is the only way to train, and endurance training is a complete waste of time. All your muscles are going to drop off, and so on and so forth. I mean, how would you look at that? Do you feel that high intensity interval training is the only way of doing this, or would you say to people, perhaps, like I said, you know, you've got to think about various factors like time available, what you're trying to achieve, and so on. I mean, what do you think are the biggest thoughts one needs to consider in utilizing HIT?
I agree, I think, with your general sentiments there. And I do see a move in some quarters to sort of demonize traditional cardio, if I can put it that way, or paint it as a black versus white or us versus them type issue. And, you know, whenever I do any sort of media things or knowledge translation efforts, I really try to put our work and the field in context a little bit and say, you know, hey, our intent here has never been to say that the public health guidelines should be scrapped or not based on very good science, or interval training is the only way to go. And I think in some ways that's what's helped to create part of the backlash about interval training. And, you know, sometimes we're quite frankly attacked, whether it's at a conference or, again, doing a media interview or something like that. And you step back a little bit and you say, hey, wait a minute, you know, where in our papers does it say that people should only, you know, you should only train by doing 3 minutes a week of very high intensity exercise? So like most things in science, I think we still don't know a lot of things, and a modest approach is best. You know, let's talk about the strengths of the research, and let's talk about the limitations as well. You know, if you'll permit me to ramble just for another minute, I'll at least when I'm talking to general health practitioners, I'll try to put this in the context and use a pharmaceutical analogy and say, you know, the public health guidelines, they're a bit like the long established drug of choice on the market that are backed up by a lot of good science, including large epidemiological type studies. Interval training is a bit like the new emerging drug on the market. It's showing a lot of promise in early trials, but we're nowhere near the grade A evidence to suggest that we might scrap the public health guidelines, or that interval-based training will confer all of the benefits of traditional endurance-type training. Clearly, I'm a proponent of interval training. I think if you compare it on an apples-to-apples basis, so if we take a given volume of interval training versus that same volume of continuous moderate intensity training, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that interval training will confer superior benefits, at least in terms of cardiorespiratory fitness, but a number of other markers as well. Again, that's a controversial statement, because if you look at large trials that have been conducted in the U.S., things like STRIDE, that have looked at intensity of exercise, they've basically come to the opposite conclusion, that it's really all about volume, and intensity plays less of a role. I do think there's something unique about the interval stimulus. So this basic idea of the pulsatile stimulus of interval training, I think it confers some unique benefits. And as I said, on an apples-to-apples volume match comparison, I think interval training comes out on top. Our laboratory has been more interested in the apples to oranges comparison, where we're comparing a relatively large amount or large volume of traditional training versus a relatively small dose of intervals. And I think there's good evidence to suggest that despite fairly marked differences in total exercise volume or training time commitment, intervals can elicit comparable benefits. And that's where I think the bang for the buck analogy comes in. Or it's being a very relatively time-efficient way to confer benefits. And I think, you know, overall, looking at the literature, that's a fair conclusion to make. Also, you know, recalling that most of the interval training studies to date have been relatively short. Our longest study has been 12 weeks, and you know, many other studies are in the 6 to 12 week range. So we don't have these long term, large scale RCTs, and I think we need to go in that direction. And those data and those comparisons will come.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it doesn't matter how we choose to slice it. One thing is for sure is there are significant benefits to this method of training. And since most people are dealing with, as we've mentioned, their lack of time one way or the other, or at least we want to optimize what we're doing with our time and perhaps incorporate some HIT and other things into a workout, which may be over the course of a week or however we wish to periodize this, I think when you look at the bigger picture, it's clearly a very valuable tool in the toolbox in approaching our fitness training strategies. So let's break this down a little bit then. There's two basic types of people that I think we should discuss, one of which is regular people with health issues. So if we look at it from a more wellness or even those who are at risk, particularly from cardiometabolic disorders, there's those. And then, of course, there's the use of this in trained people, athletes and so on. So, what are the potential benefits from this method? And we'll actually get into later on in this podcast, we can talk about the different ways we can do high intensity interval training and a few maybe protocols and so on. But let's just talk about the benefits to people with cardiometabolic health disorders and general wellness. Well, I mean, what's the benefits of doing this for them?
Sure. And maybe, you know, you mentioned we'll get into the protocols and I don't want to, you know, usurp that discussion, but I, you know, in terms of studies that have looked at people either at risk or afflicted by cardiometabolic disorders, there's been, a relatively large number of studies that have used that apples to apples type comparison, a lot of work out of Norway in particular. There's been less work that's used the apples to oranges comparison, in which, you know, you have large differences in total exercise volume. But certainly we've done a study in a small short-term study in people with type 2 diabetes. My colleague, Maureen McDonald, who's a cardiovascular physiologist, she's done a study conducted in people with coronary heart disease. So it was actually a cardiac rehabilitation study. You know, looking at the studies overall, for everyday people, if we can call it that, I think there's very good evidence that all of the major physiological systems respond and adapt. So your heart becomes a better, stronger pump, and that's evidenced by direct measures of improved stroke volume and other accessory measures like reductions in submaximal heart rate after a period of training, obviously just reflecting the fact that your heart's become a better, stronger pump. Again, my colleague Maureen, as well as others, have shown that your arteries literally become more flexible or elastic. You know, we think of hard, stiff arteries as being bad, atherosclerotic arteries. Flexible, loose arteries are good because that helps to propel the blood and oxygen to working muscle. And the muscles get better at using the oxygen. So, you know, we measure increases in mitochondrial enzymes that I've talked about before. So all of those physiological adaptations have been demonstrated in different populations, as I mentioned, including people with type 2 diabetes, people with heart disease, people with cardiovascular disease, people with metabolic syndrome. Alongside or associated with those adaptations are improved health-related markers. Obviously, cardiorespiratory fitness would be a major marker, but others have used various measures of insulin sensitivity, ranging from simple fasting glucose and insulin measurements and showing that insulin sensitivity based on those simple measures is improved. But there have been a few studies that have used what we call the gold standard markers like hyperinsulinemic euglycemic clamps and showing even with those very invasive and robust measures that insulin sensitivity can be improved in as short as 2 weeks or six sessions of interval type training. Mm.
So you mentioned insulin sensitivity, and of course that is a very popular topic, incredibly misunderstood area, of course, but it is one of interest, and I've had previous podcasts on topics that include this idea of whether or not we should be consuming less carbohydrates and so on and so forth, which I don't want to go into. But since you have Stu Phillips possibly still there in the background, I know Stu had mentioned on a previous, is either a podcast or a lecture for the ISSN diploma, I can't remember now, but he made a very important statement, which was one of the justifications for muscle mass and maintaining muscle mass in a sort of a context of obesity or insulin disorders, of course. And that, of course, is that muscle mass itself acts as a, I think the words he used was as a sink for all the sugar to disappear down to. You know, it helps deal with potential excess carbohydrates, etc., and so on and so forth, in a scenario where there might be problems with insulin. So given that that is a benefit of high-intensity interval training, could you just briefly explain the mechanisms why high-intensity interval training might actually be useful in an insulin-sensitive individual?
Yeah, and I think, and obviously Stu's quite right there, that muscle mass is very important, and it literally does serve as this sink to sort of mop up glucose. I think the mechanisms for why interval training, at least traditional cardio interval type training, if I can use that term, so things like cycling or rowing or swimming or running, why they might be effective, it has very little to do with a potential change in muscle mass, because when we've done measures either acutely, we don't see any activation of these growth signaling pathways. Things like mTOR and that are not activated, certainly to any large extent, in most people with traditional interval type training, nor do we see hypertrophy when we take biopsies and look at things like cross-sectional area. So it's not a significant hypertrophic stress, again, at least when we use cycling or running or rowing or those types of things. Mm. My suspicion is that it's related to a couple of things. Clearly, number one is there's a very clear association between mitochondrial content, mitochondrial capacity, and insulin sensitivity. We could spend probably a week, and people far more well-versed in this topic than I am, would debate the merits of whether that's a cause and effect relationship or just a correlational type measurement. But clearly there is some association with the metabolic or the aerobic capacity of muscle and measures of insulin sensitivity. I think quite clearly it is related to an enhanced capacity for glucose uptake. So we can see very marked and very rapid changes in, for example, GLUT4 content, the primary glucose transporter that's activated by exercise and muscle. Total GLUT4 content is elevated very markedly with a short period of interval type training. And so that's clearly going to at least enhance the capacity for the muscle cell to take up glucose. And we also see that muscle glycogen content is increased as a result of training as well, which reflects an increased capacity or storage extent of carbohydrate inside the muscle. So I think those are some of the potential reasons that we see improvements in measures of insulin sensitivity as a result of interval training. But clearly that's a very fruitful area of investigation, and obviously the signaling with inside muscle to take up a glucose molecule is obviously incredibly complex. So that would just be scratching at the surface of some of the major mechanisms that might be involved there.
Sure. No, that was excellent. And I've got a few experts coming on this whole topic of insulin sensitivity and insulin resistance, because as I inferred just now, it's quite a misunderstood area, I feel. So we'll have some people coming on to talk about that, because not everyone that's overweight is necessarily insulin resistant, blah, blah, blah. So, but since I mentioned the overweight word, and before we specifically talk about the benefits of this to athletes and performance, body composition, of course, is a huge focus for many people who are exercising, who may or may not have cardiometabolic problems or whatever. But virtually everyone out there, the main sort of reason to exercise is probably to influence body composition. You know, what, apart from the obvious nutritional approaches that one needs to get into, energy balance and all that, with losing body fat, what are the ways in which high intensity interval training can sort of facilitate fat loss?
Yeah, and you took, I won't belabor it, but you made the first and most important point, and that's obviously that, you know, controlling body mass, it's much easier to regulate the energy inside of the equation than the energy out. That being said, there clearly is evidence that high intensity interval training can result in some at least modest weight loss. It can also result in favorable changes in body composition as well. You know, when people say, well, how can that be if you're doing just a few short bursts of exercise? Well, number one is obviously the rate at which you're burning calories when you do short, intense exercise is extremely high. But probably more importantly is the transient elevation in metabolism in recovery from exercise. Personal trainers talk about the afterburn, and there really is something to that, although I think the magnitude of it is much less than you would expect, and certainly less than you know, a number of internet sites would suggest. But we've measured this in our laboratory by making 24-hour measures of oxygen uptake following different types of exercise. Other labs have done this as well. And you can see a measurable increase in energy expenditure and recovery compared to, for example, a more moderate intensity form of exercise. So both interval training and continuous training would elevate metabolism during recovery compared to the control or resting condition. But interval training results in, again, a transiently elevated rate of afterburn. And so if you do that repeatedly, those are going to add up over time, just like, you know, eating a candy a day is going to add up over time. This is, you know, you're going in the opposite direction, and it can lead to measurable changes either in body weight or in body composition. It's interesting, the body composition one is a little bit harder to figure out, because as I mentioned earlier, we don't see evidence of robust muscle hypertrophy after this type of training. And yet in a couple of studies where we've used DEXA measurements, we do see, again, small but significant changes in body mass, such that lean mass is elevated and fat mass is reduced a little bit. You know, you can build the case for why fat mass is reduced a bit based on some of the mechanisms we talked earlier. It's a little bit harder to make the case for why lean mass is elevated, although it may be that there's slight elevations in protein synthesis in a couple of pools, a couple of subpopulations within the muscle. I know Dr. Phillips is actively researching this area, so it might not necessarily be just the myofibrillar, the contractile pools that are being stimulated and increased. Some other pools may be as well. But suffice to say, intervals have been demonstrated to be effective at causing some small but favorable changes in body composition.
Great, yes. So we've talked about the potential sort of wellness benefits of high-intensity interval training, cardiometabolic patients or people, and insulin sensitivity and all that stuff, body composition and so on. So now the next sort of focus should be on those that are just a little bit fitter, as in athletes themselves. And I know it can be pretty hard to convince certain kinds of athletes to change their training, particularly when they feel that it's working quite well for them, particularly endurance athletes who feel they just should go out there and hit the roads and just go out and run for hours on end. You know, why should they be considering high intensity interval training, other than of course some of the things we've discussed with regards to time efficiency and so on? I mean, why should those guys be doing this?
I would suggest that there's, again, to my, so point number one is, again, your listeners would well know, is the available scientific data, at least in the published literature, on truly elite or even very highly trained individuals is modest. You know, most of our studies are on recreationally active men and women. So I guess point number one is obviously there's limited research. But I think there's very good published data to support the idea that, first of all, interval training in general, but more specifically, interval training on the higher end of the spectrum, so these relatively short, relatively intense bursts of activity are effective. There was a lot of good work that came out of South Africa in the late 1990s. From Tim Noakes' lab, especially when people like John Hawley, who's now in Australia, were working there. Some very good studies on cyclists. More recently, there's been data out of Denmark that has looked at highly trained runners. And these studies utilized interval training that was basically 30-second repeats at a very high intensity, either all out or intensities that would demand 150-175% of the power output that would elicit VO2 max. And they showed measurable increases in performance, not just markers. So, for example, 40-kilometer cycling time trial speed in people who are already national-caliber type cyclists. In the running studies, improvements in 3-kilometer, 10-kilometer race times in people who were competitive distance runners who were already incorporating interval-type training in their studies. So, again, these are limited numbers of studies. I don't want to overstate it in terms of the preponderance of evidence, but to answer your question, I would say it's because there's published evidence that highly trained individuals can benefit from this type of approach. And I'll just mention a third study that was actually done in the UK, where they were looking at different training models. Obviously, there's, you know, lots of talk around polarized threshold training, what's best, you know, 3-zone, 5-zone training, stuff like that. But the upshot from this one study was that a polarized approach was superior, again, in highly trained individuals. And this was, you know, taking an interval-based training approach.
Excellent. And I think in the last 37 minutes or whatever we've been talking so far, I think it's quite clear that there's multiple benefits and applications to this method of training. And as I mentioned, it's a useful strategy, and you just need to learn how to use it and get the most out of it. And, you know, we're not going to cover this in any great detail in this podcast. And of course, I do recommend people do look at the literature, and your paper that I referenced is a good start, and there's some great references to follow up from in there. But we're about to run out of time here, so I just wanted to finish, Martin, with just from a practical perspective. We haven't got time to go through high-intensity interval protocols for every scenario, but since the most common, you know, situation is going to be just sort of regular people helping them lose body fat, what would you recommend is a good practical sort of protocol that personal trainers and fitness coaches and even doctors or whatever might suggest to their clients or patients?
Sure. Certainly, we've done a number of studies with these 30-second all-out sprint models, but that takes some specialized laboratory equipment. I think these all-out sprint-type devices, you may see them starting to come on the market, but I don't think those are necessarily practical or realistic for most people at this point in time. You know, I'll point to a model that we've used and now others have as well, and it's simply 1 minute or a 60-second repeat separated or followed by 60 seconds or 1 minute of recovery repeated 10 times. So basically 10 1-minute intervals with 1 minute of recovery. The intensity for the 1 minute efforts is about an 8 out of 10 on an RPE scale, or about 85 to 90% of maximal heart rate on average. So obviously when people are doing that first 1 minute repeat, you know, their RPE values may be down around 6 or 7, and it might only elicit about 70% of their maximal heart rate. But as they progress through the 10 intervals, obviously the cumulative stress is going to be there. And on average, when we measure it, it's around 85, 88% of maximal heart rate. We've used that protocol, first of all, to demonstrate that it can be as effective as those shorter, fewer, very high intensity efforts. And probably more importantly, we've done a study like that in people with type 2 diabetes. We used recumbent or seated cycling because it's obviously a bit more comfortable for older individuals. So these were people about 65 years of age that had type 2 diabetes, that did only 6 sessions of interval training over 2 weeks. And we showed marked improvements by about a millimole in their 24-hour average blood sugar. My colleague Maureen McDonald has done a 12-week interval training study using that 10-by-1-minute model in people who had cardiovascular disease. So that was a cardiac rehabilitation program where they were comparing usual care versus the 10-by-1-minute model, which was less than half the time in terms of total time commitment. Maureen showed it was very well tolerated in the people that she worked with. Again, these were cardiac rehabilitation individuals. And it was very effective in terms of improving their cardiorespiratory fitness, as well as some of those markers that I talked about earlier, looking at vascular indices of health. So I think that 10-by-1-minute model would be an example that I'd point to right now, but also making the point that there's probably, you know, certainly for general fitness, there's many different interval training approaches that are likely to be effective. And something as simple as just adopting the interval-based approach. I know we're getting pressed for time, but there was a study out of Denmark recently that compared constant intensity walking at about 65% of maximal heart rate versus interval walking, where people were just bumping it up a little bit, maybe going to 70, 75% of maximal heart rate, and then backing off. The interval-based approach was much better over 4 months in people that had type 2 diabetes for improving their fitness, their body composition, and their blood sugar. So it doesn't have to be these all-out models, and just this idea of peaks and valleys. Again, there appears to be something very effective about that.
Very good. I mean, it is safe to say sometimes the simplest things are the best things, aren't they? And we're always in danger of overcomplicating things, either as nutritionists or as, you know, physiologists or personal trainers or whatever, and just sometimes just keep it nice and simple, because the benefits can be great. You know, you just need to learn how to integrate that into someone's lifestyle and so on, which, by the way, reminds me of a question, because one thing people tend to do is they come across stuff like this and then they take this more is better approach. So they'll start doing high intensity interval trainings every day of the week. I mean, at what point do you think it's a case of overdoing it in the context of regular people? Obviously with athletes there's going to be a different thought here, but just for average people going to the gym, working out, should they be doing this stuff every day, or should they maybe restrict it to a certain number of times per week? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'd say they shouldn't be doing it every day. And, it, you know, it's one of those where if you're doing it properly, it's probably self-correcting, and that it's actually very, you know, one thing we've sort of glossed over here is, you know, there's no free lunch. Interval training can be an uncomfortable way to train, even though you don't have to do very much of it. It's uncomfortable. It hurts when you're working hard. And so, you know, for people to try and do it every day, generally speaking, we're not talking about the athletes because obviously they're highly, highly motivated. But for the average person, they're either not going to do it every day or they're going to do it incorrectly. And what I mean by that is they're going to lower the intensity. They might still go for a minute on, a minute off, but they're not going to be doing it at 85 or 90%. So clearly there's a risk for doing too much of this. And we would not suggest that people should be doing this every day. And, you know, I'd come back to the point we talked about earlier. I think variety is always going to be best. Clearly, there's some people that interval training is not going to be palatable for, and we could tell them to do it until they're blue in the, we're blue in the face, but they're not going to listen because they don't enjoy that type of exercise. And so finding what works for you is always best. That being said, there is you know, evidence that people can find this type of training to actually be more enjoyable. Like anything in science, you can pick your studies, and it's how you ask the question. But I think there's evidence now that people, clearly there's evidence that people will adopt this type of training. They can find it enjoyable, and they will adhere to it and certainly derive benefits.
Great. Thank you so much, Martin. I think we've done a good job here to introduce the topic. And as I mentioned, folks can just Google Martin Gibala high intensity interval training, and usually one way or the other you find lots and lots of stuff from you guys. But as I mentioned, the Journal of Physiology paper that you did with John Hawley, Maureen McDonald, Jonathan Little, and yourself, of course, Physiological Adaptations to Low Volume High Intensity Interval Training in Health and Disease, is a good paper, and it's easily available. So I do recommend everyone reads that. So I do appreciate your time there, Martin. It's been wonderful to have you talk about this. So that brings us to the end of this We Do Science Guru Performance podcast. I of course am Laurent Bannock from Guru Performance. If you want to learn more about these podcasts, check us out at guruperformance.com, where also you'll find lectures and studies on these topics, also from people like Stu Phillips, of course, who's somewhere in the background possibly, on the ISSN diploma program that we deliver on a worldwide basis. I also lead a program at Middlesex University here in London, where we also get into some of this stuff, and more details on that at guruperformance.com. So anyway, I shall end it there.